Welcome to the Social Science of War. This podcast is brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. We bring together scholars and practitioners to better understand warfare, the Army, and national security strategy. The views expressed in this episode do not represent the views of West Point or any agency of the U.S. government. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Social Science of War podcast. My name is Alexandra Chinchilla, and I'm an assistant professor at Texas A&M University at the Bush School of Government and Public Service. And today we're going to be talking about the war in Ukraine. This is a topic that is very close to my heart. I've been researching the conflict on and off since it began in the Donbas 10 years ago, and we really are at an inflection point. It's a very important point in the conflict. We keep hearing a lot in the West about how people are tired of paying attention to what's going on in Ukraine, but the reality is that Ukraine needs Western aid now more than ever. There's a lot of podcasts that you can follow to learn updates on what's actually happening on the battlefield. That's not what we're going to be talking about today. Instead, we're going to zoom out and we're going to look at the big picture. What does it look like in Ukraine from the perspective of defense reform and governance issues, which are actually really critical for helping Ukraine win the war and for setting Ukraine up well for what comes after the war? And this is an area where our guests argue that Western help can actually be really important. They make the case for why they think the West should be doing more to help these defense reform and governance issues and why Western aid for Ukraine is needed in general. So I'm really excited to welcome on the show today two extremely knowledgeable experts on Ukraine. Our first guest is Dr. Polina Belyakova. She is currently a postdoctoral fellow at the MIT Security Studies Program, and she has a PhD in political science from Tufts University. She is a native Ukrainian and Russian speaker, so she has a lot of expertise in the country of Ukraine itself, and she's an expert on civil-military relations and the use of force. She's done extensive fieldwork in Ukraine and Russia, as well as digital fieldwork in Israel as part of her ongoing book project that looks at civil-military issues in these countries. Our next guest is Don Bowser. He is a law enforcement and security expert with over 25 years' experience in governance issues, mainly in transition and conflict countries. This includes conflict-affected areas such as Sierra Leone, Iraq, Afghanistan, and South Sudan. And importantly for our purposes, he has extensive experience in the post-Soviet space. He spent most of the last 10 years in Ukraine. And after Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022, he was engaged as the founder of the NGO Support to Ukraine Recovery Initiative, which delivers non-lethal military assistance to military forces in Ukraine. He's also involved in a variety of different projects, including evaluating the effectiveness of Western assistance to Ukraine. Polina, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Don, thank you for coming on with us today.
Great, thanks, Helen.
So the first question I wanted to discuss, I'll direct this to Polina. You've written extensively about civil-military relations in democracies and autocracies. You've looked at Russia, Ukraine, and Israel. So could you talk a little bit about the current state of civil-military relations in Ukraine and how that's holding up with the ongoing war?
Thank you for your question. I will address the big picture first. When I think about civil-military relations, I think about a triangle relationship between the government, the military, and the broader society. So answering to your question, I will refer to all three of these components. And at the moment, as we're recording this conversation, the Ukrainian civil-military relations are contentious. Contentious because there are some tensions between the government and the top military officers. There is a resulting tension between the society and the government pertaining to the perspectives of mobilization. And also the question of trust now between the society and the military because of the recent changes in the military command. At the same time, while civil-military relations are contentious, they are not problematic. We're not talking coups, we're not talking any other kind of takeovers or the military leveraging its way into politics. There are some tensions that are normal for democracies. And for Ukraine to live through this moment with that level of tensions while fighting a war is actually an achievement in civil-military relations and civilian control of the military.
Yeah, very much so. We talked about the shakeup in the military command and tensions between the president's office and General Zelensky. Is this typical for countries that are experiencing war, and what can we make of why that happened at this particular time?
When I think about Zelensky's decision to fire Zaluzhny, it's helpful to first acknowledge that we don't know the facts. We can speculate, assume, read the tea leaves, and that's exactly what we're going to do here. What I find analytically helpful is to think about two groups of reasons why President Zelensky might have decided to fire the commander-in-chief Zaluzhny. First is political reasons. There are rumors from multiple sources that Zelensky saw Zaluzhny as a political competitor. And there are several observable implications that go beyond rumors. First, the senior military officer of a state appearing on the Times cover can be a good or a bad thing, and it's good as long as they don't have any disagreement with the political leadership of the state. And recently, that stopped to be true for Ukraine. The second is, of course, Zaluzhny's essay for The Economist, which put Zelensky in a very precarious situation in which Zelensky had to respond to the points made by Zaluzhny to the Western press, of course, read by the Western partners of Ukraine. It is not a situation in which a leader of a democratic state wants to find themselves. So that's political reasons. The second group of reasons that I think about is the professional reasons, divided in past and future. The past is, of course, the Ukrainian offensive that did not deliver on the promise. And the future is the war plans. And here we're again in the realm of rumors rather than facts. There are some testimonies from Ukraine saying that the president and the ex-commander-in-chief had different views about the war plans. What was the difference? Is the subject of speculation. Some say that Zelensky has a more ambitious plan than Zaluzhny was ready to formulate and follow through with. The second group of people say that Zaluzhny was not ready to formulate a plan with so many unknowns in the equation. We don't know what's true here, but from the fact of Zelensky's decision, I can assume that it's rather the professional reasons that drove his decision. And here is why. Zelensky would have had much more control over Zaluzhny politically if Zaluzhny stayed in his position. Now the political field is actually open for Zaluzhny, and it's up to him what does he do with all the authority that comes with the popular trust in him and the military that he led for the last 2 years. So concluding, if we think about why Zelensky fired Zaluzhny and what does it mean, I would say that we have to first think about the professional disagreements about how the war should be fought in Ukraine, and only then take the political consideration in account, because they definitely added to the situation, but I seriously doubt that the political reasons were the leading ones due to which Zelensky made the decision.
So one of those military reasons about how the war was being fought was the prospect of more mobilization, at least from what is reported in the press, that General Zaluzhny was an advocate of mobilizing additional soldiers for the war effort. And President Zelensky, from some of his public statements, may have been more interested in considering how to use existing forces more effectively to still relieve soldiers at the front. What do you make of that angle?
So the development of the situation with mobilization also supports my hypothesis that the reasons were rather professional, because now we see that Zaluzhny is gone, but the government is actually proceeding with the mobilization. It could have been very easy to blame Zaluzhny for this initiative to mobilize Ukrainians and what I call in my research civil indifference to the military. Zelensky could have deferred to Zaluzhny publicly and shield himself from the political consequences of a very unpopular decision to mobilize more Ukrainians to fight in war. Instead, he did exactly the opposite. He fired Zaluzhny, and now he's standing there alone with the decision to continue developing the legal basis for the new mobilization.
So to some extent, this to me sounds, for what you said, like a win for civil-military relations, right? Because the civilians are clearly in control, even though in wartime is when they tend to delegate the most to professional military commanders.
The truth is, it's difficult to answer this question in the moment. We need a more wide time horizon. But if I had to code this moment, I would definitely code it as a sieve mill success. Despite of the personal preferences of different experts regarding Zaluzhny and Zelensky, when we think about the institutions and not the personalities, Ukrainian civ mil works exactly as democratic civil-military relations should work.
So Don, I want to bring you in here a little bit into the conversation. So you've worked extensively in Ukraine on these issues of democratic reform and governance. What's your perspective on the events that we were just discussing?
Well, Polina is correct in terms of that civ-mil relations have gone a long way since 2014. I've been in the sort of circle of defense reform people in Kyiv since 2014, so seen the progress of where it's made. Many of the sort of key people around the reforms office within the Ministry of Defense and within the general staff, I know. However, on the specific question of the Zelensky-Zaluzhny relationship, let's look back at the timeline of what's happened. Sirski was put forward as a potential replacement as early as mid-22. So, you know, mid-22 already, there was an attempt to make the cult of personality around Sirski. There was a lot of positive press. His role in the Battle of Kyiv was greatly exaggerated by the PR machine that runs out of Bankova. So we had that. And then in November of last year, all of Zaluzhny's, except for one, advisors were fired. So that's kind of an indicator when you walk into the office and all of your close advisors around you, except for one, are gone. And one was blown up by a grenade. So hard to say that, you know, this has been simply a spur of the moment or, you know, that there was a decision professionally that they wanted to go in a different direction. It seems pretty clear that since late last year, the writing was on the wall for Zaluzhny's removal. So like I said, you have a long-term project to prepare people to replace Zaluzhny. And Zaluzhny, who is absolutely non-political entity, he's never played politics, never tried to play politics, but he is more popular than the presidential administration at the moment and continues to be. Sirski was number three at best of people that could replace him. And so the Kyiv Institute of Sociology just published data on this. What are people's attitudes towards this? It's an incredibly unpopular move. Why now? That's what many people ask. I don't know. I mean, it's a very odd time to go through this vast shakeup. And I got a lot of panic phone calls from people in Kyiv asking for some assistance on policy issues over the last week. So it's clear that military reforms are kind of moving along. But if you're going to replace somebody who's incredibly popular, at the same time, you bring in somebody like Igor Plahuta, who was in charge of the internal troops at the time of Maidan, so directly has blood of Ukrainians on his hands, was brought in to head up the territorial defense units. That is very troubling. So if we look at terms of civ-mil through the lens of the presidential administration, that's one thing. Civ-mil in terms of the popular support and people's attitudes, the army remains the most trusted institution now in the country. This wasn't the case in 2014, wasn't the case in 2016, right? But it is now and continues to be now. So social cohesion is reaching a breaking point at the moment. And there's a lot of indicators to show this, that there's a crisis coming in terms of social cohesion between the civilian population who supports the army and the presidential administration on the other side. So there's a lot of worrying signals right now about long-term political stability in the country for this move and for many other moves that are ongoing. Does it bring anything militarily? Well, there's a stalemate at the moment. Are these shakeups in terms of promoting some very competent commanders, for example, like the 93rd Mechanized Brigade being promoted, who is a performer? But on the other hand, you have Sirski, someone who is very politicized and very willing to follow whatever orders are given to him. Very Soviet model of sort of leadership. And then you have a guy like Plahuta who has no problem with crushing anybody who stands against the administration. So I think there are a lot of sort of troubling indicators out there. And basically, it's this attempt now to rein in the military to not be any potential threat to future stability in the country. There is no history of Bonapartism within Soviet structures until the putsch in 91 or afterwards since then, right? So we haven't seen this. Is there the chance of the military rebelling? I don't know. I see a lot of worrying indicators between what people on the front line say and what their worries are and their attitudes towards the presidential administration. So I wouldn't classify civ-mil relationships right now in terms of the civilian population, the army, and the current presidential administration as being a rosy picture where everything is stable. In fact, there's a lot of worrying indicators that it's going the other way.
I just would like to slightly clarify and on some points to push back on several points that Don made. Because while it's true that the military now is the most trusted institution in Ukraine, according to the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology, it had been more popular than the security service of Ukraine, the president of Ukraine, the government of Ukraine, and the parliament of Ukraine as early as December 2015 and December 2018. It was not most popular only because the church topped the rating. So the Ukrainian military being trusted more than the Ukrainian government is not a new phenomenon in Ukrainian politics. And I would really invite us to be very cautious, again, when we switch the level of analysis from institutions to personalities, because what we see and what we know about personalities does not really give us a very sharp analytical lens when we have to assess civil-military relations. Again, that's why I agree that there is a lot of tensions between the society, the military, and the government. That's why I call them as contentious. At the same time, if we worry about major power distributions between the government and the military happening anytime soon, I don't see that in Ukraine. So we should pay attention. And another remark, because as Don was talking, there is an important point that you mentioned, but I want to stress, I think the contentious nature of civil-military relations in Ukraine can also be a strategic vulnerability that Russia can exploit. And that's why I agree that it's important to look at this with nuance, not to see them as rosy, but see them as a potential strategic vulnerability that Russia may exploit sometime soon. Because it's not only us who are paying attention, it's also the Kremlin, and I'm sure they have their plans on how to exploit this contentious civil-military relations that we see today in Ukraine.
Absolutely. And it's clear that the Kremlin is just waiting for social cohesion to break in Ukraine to use it to their military advantage. This is why this is so troubling. On the question of personalities versus institutions, sorry, but in the last 30 years, personalities have been far stronger than institutions in Ukraine. Right? It's always been personality driven. The political parties are personality driven political parties. So this is the way that it's been. It's not ideology based or anything else. It's personality driven. So the entire post-independence history of Ukraine is driven by personalities, whether it be oligarchs, whether it be key political figures or whatever else. It's always been, and that's been one of the problems. And this was exactly my argument in 2015 when we set up the anti-corruption structure in Ukraine, is let's make it institutional, not personality driven. The donors were not really understanding why Ukraine should have independent institutions, meaning independent also from the donors. And this has been one of the things that NATO has been constantly talking about for the last 10 years, is that you need to have these institutional realities. We're still not there. And every day I see it in talking to friends within the different command structures, is that this is personalities. Why doesn't Group A cooperate with Group B within Special Forces? It's personalities. It's not institutional based.
Now, I would like to make a remark regarding the personality, because I agree that specifically Ukrainian politics is very personality driven. But what we're attempting to do here is to provide some analysis and maybe foresight. And looking at personalities gives us very rich data pool. And without the benefit of hindsight, we cannot really deduce. I understand today that appointing Plahuta is very problematic because his role as the commander of the internal troops during Maidan is, to put it mildly, controversial. At the same time, many Maidan protesters actually remember him as the person who negotiated with the protesters to withdraw the troops from the governmental quarter. The point is, knowing that about his past does not really help us predict how he will serve as the new person responsible to the territorial defense forces. We just don't know. It's a very problematic appointment, but I cannot connect two dots at the moment. And from like individual biography to deduce what kind of commander of the territorial defense forces he will make. And the same applies to Sirski. his biography has really bright and really dark spots, but it's very difficult to predict how they will shine in the new position to which Zelensky just appointed him.
So we talked a little bit about institutions and Ukraine's progress that has been made since 2014 on strengthening civil military institutions, strengthening institutions of governance, and addressing chronic issues like security reform. Could you two talk a little bit about the progress that's been made there and how those reform efforts are continuing during the ongoing war?
I would like to point three major directions of reforms that started before the full-scale invasion and reflect a little bit on their current progress. So first is the territorial defense forces that were reformed just before the invasion began. So at the time of the full-scale Russian invasion, the legal basis was there for the territorial defense forces, but they were not fully developed, trained, and equipped as a new force. However, in 2022, that reform provided a crucial difference when we compare 2022 to 2014, the difference in how to mobilize the volunteers, the reserves, the Ukrainians who are willing to join the military to defend their country, the traditional military mobilization infrastructure just could not process fast enough and on a regional basis. So the reform of the territorial defense forces is a great success in Ukraine. Another step that is part of reforms is separating the roles of commander-in-chief and the chief of the general staff that proved to be a success in terms of civilian control in Ukraine. It happened before the Russia's full-scale invasion, and I would argue that it improved civil-military relations and command structure. Another set of reforms, however, they started before the full-scale invasion and they dragged through even after the invasion started, is reforming the Ukroboronprom, the military manufacturing and defense procurement system. So I spoke to several people who were directly involved in reforming. Ukroboronprom is a state-owned organization that is responsible for manufacturing the weapons and military goods. And surprisingly, from my interviews with people who are directly involved with the reform, I discovered that the full-scale invasion, counterintuitively, even helped to speed up the reform because some of the people and processes that created unnecessary complexity in the process were eliminated because of the sense of urgency, and we see that Ukroboronprom was reformed. How much of a success it will be in the future, I don't know, but that's one of the examples of how the full-scale invasion did not stop the reform, but actually helped speed it up. If you ask me if I had to prioritize one reform direction, is everything that pertains to the state defense order. It's the reform that started before the full-scale invasion, and unfortunately was not finalized before Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022. And still there are a lot of blind spots in that process. So a state defense order would be the priority reform direction for Ukraine when it comes to its security sector governance and ability to defend itself in the future.
Great points, Polina, on this. Ukroboronprom has been a swamp for many, many, many years, even before 2014. After 2014, really no reforms substantially were done with it. It continued to be a major source of corruption across many different weapon systems. Lviv Tank Factory or the counter-battery procurement, the same thing with in terms of procuring boats, which took the United States 5 years just to give away boats because of the dark actors within Ukroboronprom. It continues to be a swamp of corruption and more of a blockage to acquiring capabilities rather than anything else. So when you talk to people within the system who are really responsible for key reforms, like the guys at Eurorozvitka or other people, their quote is always that, you know, we've been able to succeed with reforms not because of the state, but in spite of the state. So what happened since February 22? Well, logistics command wasn't reformed immediately. So that became a problem. And a lot of weapons didn't reach the front in a very timely and efficient manner. Training command wasn't essentially reformed. So yes, we had TDF. People went to the front to fight. But was there any system in place in terms of training Ukrainians? you invited all of these internationals to come. And so every person in the world who wanted to live out a fantasy of war came in. At the same time, you had real professionals from Special Forces and other units within the West who came. They weren't utilized in any effective way. And they felt very frustrated, and most of them have left for exactly that reason. You had the Gour Legion, which was slightly more professional, but the International Legion has been something that could have been the basis of training on NATO weapons and NATO standards. And that never was, because if you had a guy who was a cook in the Army who shows up and all of a sudden he's, you know, pretending to be a Special Forces guy, it's been kind of a very negative effect on what it was intended to be, which was a PR exercise. So when you look at those key aspects of it, logistics and training, those reforms still haven't been fully implemented. Yes, some of them were in the works, but they were never successfully implemented over the last 2 years. Military procurement, and I'm writing a piece for this right now on War in the Rocks, military procurement continues to be an unmitigated disaster. $400 million has disappeared in the last 5 months. $400 million U.S. dollars has disappeared from the military procurement system at a time when Ukraine is fighting for its existence. So no matter how we want to dress this up, it's clear that, you know, there are fundamental things that should have been cleared up over the last 2 years and weren't. And specifically on the military procurement, last spring, I went to Kyiv. I spent 6 weeks begging everybody up to the deputy minister level to take the corruption issue seriously, or they were going to have real problems getting access to Western weapons. And I was told point blank, there is no political will to do that. So Reznikov gets replaced, and still you're way behind the ball. And again, this impacts on society's views on this. The military recruitment system. You would think that this would be something that would be, you know, looked at and closely overseen. No, you have literally millions and millions taken in bribes that are siphoned out of the country. For example, in Odessa, it was over 6 million just from one district's military commissioner. So how can you explain that if there's actually a serious? So knowing the people that have been trying to push for reforms within the ministry and within the general staff for the last decade, it's been extremely frustrating. Have things changed in the last little while? Yes. It seems that the eternally suffering Department of Reforms within the Ministry of Defense is now being reconstituted and is actually trying to struggle with this. But again, this is 2 years after the full-scale invasion. So from a institutional level analysis, if you were to do any sort of functional analysis or dysfunctional analysis of things within the military sector, you can see that there was a lot of things that should have been done over the last 2 years and simply weren't. Why? I don't know. But it was clear from being in Kyiv during the siege, you know, as soon as the Russians were pushed out of the area, everything went back to normal. Everybody was riding their electro scooters around Kyiv. Everybody was relaxing in bars. And what we didn't see is this sense of urgency that you had during the siege of Kyiv. And you could see it from the institutional side that the administration itself basically, you know, thought, okay, great, we have this. All we have to do is fight a little bit more and Russia will give up. And we all hope for that, but that's not what happened. So, I mean, this is one of the problematic things is that, yes, some reforms have continued, but not at the pace and not at the depth that they should have been, given the seriousness of the situation. And now we're back to the same situation that we had in 2016, where we see a stalemate coming. Are real reforms going to go through? We can hope so. It seems like there are competent people now being appointed within the ministry. But is that going to be enough? Is the political will there to drive home real reform? And this is what I said. When you look at the military recruitment system and everything else that has happened over the last year, after scandal after scandal after scandal. Deputy Minister of Defense was found in the summer of 22 with all kinds of U.S. dollars in his sofa. Ukrainsky Pravda reports it, and then the journalists were threatened by the administration. A couple of months later, the body cam images from Naboo were shown that showed exactly that's what happened and what they had reported. So you had a chance in the summer of 22 to say, yes, we have to clamp down this has to stop. We have to push through these reforms. And that didn't happen. So I'm very sort of weary that we're so far into the conflict now, after 10 years of conflict, and still the reforms have been so minimal in terms of fundamental. Maybe this is the wake-up call now. Maybe these new appointments will drive it home. Maybe now the political will exist. We'll see. But I don't know how much more time Ukraine has to just sit back and hope for the best.
Yeah, I would like to address one of the points that I think ironically rhymes with our earlier discussion when you mentioned why the reforms are not proceeding. I think that in true fashion of Ukrainian politics, instead of reforming the institutions, the Ukrainian political establishment is replacing the people. So when we see the absence, so the Ukrainian government takes more personalist approach rather than institutional to solving, for example, the corruption issues. And when we talk about the political will, it is appalling that 2 years into war, we find so many instances of corruption. At the same time, the political will is the issue of motivation. And it's counterintuitive that the motivation is not there. But what I would like to highlight is the issue of capability. Why is it even possible to go through a tender at the Ministry of Defense and approve the provision of goods by a company that has never provided these goods before? There is something in the institutional processes and norms that have to be changed, and not just replacing Reznikov with Umerov and one commander with another. So it's interesting how our approaches to analyzing Ukrainian politics actually rhyme with the issues of Ukrainian politics, which is, again, very person-centered and not institutions and policies centered.
That's right on, Polina. But, you know, I mean, this is the thing. Having been in the end of the Soviet days, I studied in Odessa at the end of the Soviet days, and you saw how the institutions just crumbled away. Steve Solnick has written some very good stuff about this, right? About the lack of actual institutionalization. And then you see this in the last 30 years that the institutions themselves have not been the focus of this. Ironically, that was one of the things that the European Union was trying to do within Ukraine, was trying to build up institutions, as they do as they go along in their process. And then Brussels had the idea that we should do de-oligarchization. And so the head of the support group for Ukraine working on these issues made the comment, is that, what do you think we've been doing? By building institutions, we get rid of the influence of the oligarchs. It's not personality-driven, but it's institutional-driven. And in the current, Misha Minnikov just wrote a great piece on the de-oligarchization. But the fact is that there is nothing institutionally in place to stop the new oligarchs from emerging, and they already are emerging. So you get rid of Kolomoisky, Benya's gone, and then what? The new guy comes in. And it's a new guy who's under the auspices of the presidential administration, and he's going to be the develop into it. So this has been the chronic history of the last 30 years, is that there's a failure to develop the institutions to be able to respond to these things, and especially within the defense sector. You know, it's 10 years into this, and it was so frustrating to see that after the Maidan activists kicked in the doors of the Ministry of Defense and went in as special advisors, and you had the full support of the international community, that very little actual real reforms were done because of the economic private interests of individuals within the system. Ukroborprom wasn't reformed. Why? Because it was just a trough to feed from many, many different people. And it's criminal what has gone on, even in the last couple of years. Since 2019, major weapon systems procurement were shut down. Counter-battery is still something. Electronic warfare is still something. I saw those programs get derailed, and they would be saving a lot of Ukrainian lives right now. So at the end of the day, people within sort of this greater defense community know exactly what's going on. And that frustration is boiling to the point in which you have a lot of veterans, you have a lot of people who lost limbs, you have a lot of families who lost lives in the defense of Ukraine. How much is our patience going to be for half-hearted reforms or half measures? And that's why I really think there should be some serious work done in terms of looking at social cohesion.
I want to come now to the role of the international community. So some people might hear what you both just talked about and throw up their hands and say, I've seen this drill before. The United States tried to do this for 20 years all around the world, and every time it's failed, there's no way to bring reform, and why are we even in Ukraine? What would you two say to that?
Well, on that point, I might jump in. Having been in both Iraq and Afghanistan and extensive Afghanistan experience, the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan had 12 ambassadors. They don't even have 12 bodies at Sikorsky 4, the U.S. Embassy, right? So if you're looking at the level of input Brits are a little bit more forward-leaning. They have three or four one-stars that are actually on the ground in Kiev helping on these issues. You know, you see the Lithuanians or the Poles or other people engage. But the fact is that many of the major powers are hardly present in Kiev. Where are the Germans? How many people are at the German embassy? How many people are at the American embassy? How many people are there? So this has been one of the big issues, is that when we talk about the international community, who are we talking about? Who's actually on the ground? Again, it comes down to the institutions. How many bodies are on the ground able to give actual advice to Ukrainians? You can't do it from Zhezhov. You can't do it from Washington. You have to be there. Is Kiev more dangerous than Kabul or Baghdad? Absolutely not. And again, on an average, you know, Friday night in Kiev, you wouldn't even know there was a war on unless the air raids come in. So, I mean, this has been one of the problems, is that it's been very strange that given that this is the prime conflict of the world, if you compare it to other conflicts, the footprint of the international community is so small these days.
I would like to add a point about the actual presence of Ukraine's Western partners on the ground. And Don, you were talking about the number of bodies, and the example with the number of ambassadors is very telling. But I would also like to underscore not the number of people, but the political power and influence that they bring with them. We can send, 18 Ministry of Defense advisors, MODAs, to Kyiv. But these people come with very little political power behind their back to actually push the Ukrainian government on making very difficult decisions. So I agree, it has to be the ambassadors or higher, because otherwise sending more people does not solve the problem, but sending maybe few people, but with true political power behind their position, would be very helpful, first for monitoring, but also for influencing what's going on the ground. And so far, we don't see that in Ukraine. We did not see it after 2014, before Russian missiles started falling in Kyiv, Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, Odessa, Lviv. And we don't see it after that. So yes, Kyiv being, or any other Ukrainian city, being a dangerous place is a poor excuse, because we did not see very extensive political involvement of the Western partners in defense reforms even before Russia's full-scale invasion. At the same time, I don't want our listeners who have not been to Ukraine or who do not have relatives in Ukraine to think that Ukraine is a peaceful country where everyone rides scooters and sits at hotels every day. I'm from Kyiv. My mother still lives in Kyiv. My friends are in Kyiv. It's not as peaceful as might occur from this conversation, because the missiles are actually falling in the middle of Kyiv and the debris are hitting properties. But at the same time, it does not prevent people from real political influence to being present in Ukraine, at least on a semi-permanent basis. It's a poor excuse.
You're absolutely right, Polina, about this. But, you know, is Kyiv dangerous? Yeah. Okay, you have missile attacks, you have everything. In comparison to the complex attacks that I lived through in Kabul, or what went on daily in terms of Baghdad and things like that, so there is a level of risk. People believe that somehow, you know, somebody in Washington is picking up the phone and giving orders to Zelensky. And this is the most unrealistic thing that I've ever heard of. Nobody is giving any instructions to Bankova, and then they're immediately doing it. The NATO summit was the clearest indicator. So Vilnius was just a disaster in terms of building a stronger alliance with everybody. But the thought that many people have is that somehow the Brits or the Germans or the Americans are able to instruct Ukraine, do a counteroffensive, don't do a counteroffensive, is just nonsense. Ukraine is a sovereign country. They're very much defending their sovereignty, and they've never been very good at taking orders from people from outside. So, you know, I mean, this is one of the greatest misnomers of this conflict, is that people think that the level of influence that the Western powers have in Kyiv is anywhere equivalent to what it was in Afghanistan or even Libya or anywhere else. No, they really don't have the ability to micromanage. They try. They tried 2014, and Roman Vashuk, our Canadian ambassador, wrote a great piece, gave a great speech at Harvard about this, about the attempts of Western powers to try and micromanage Ukraine, and it failed miserably, and it's failing now, right? So there's a limited ability to influence things. But still, it would send a very strong message if you had a much bigger footprint on the ground, and it would give a much clearer picture, because who do people listen to? That's the problem. If you can't get outside the compound, you can't interact with people on a daily basis. And this has always been, since 2014, Paulina had it absolutely right. You know, people sat in Kiev at the embassies and they talked to, you know, the same half a dozen voices, which were absolutely not representative of Ukraine. They weren't talking to people, Donchani from the Donbass or, you know, people out in Kryvyi Rih or wherever else. They were listening to mostly people from the reanimation package of reforms in Kiev and some others. And that was it. So we're still faced with that problem, is that there is a lack of real analytical ability from not being able to freely interact with people across the country and to get a clear picture of what's going on.
Interestingly, this topic of conversation, even though it's not Ukraine specific, it's important to remember that here we enter the topic that, Alex, actually pertains to your research is U.S. security assistance, and something that I now research is civil-military relations on the U.S. side when the United States provides security assistance to recipient countries. And what I observe, and Alex, correct me if you have different view on that, is that security assistance was first engineered as a foreign policy tool, but it's now mostly implemented by the military. So the ambassadors are often sidelined. So the absence of civilians with political power on the ground is an echo of a deeper problem that does not originate in Ukraine. It is a symptom of a different political process that is happening here in the United States and the division of responsibilities between the State Department and the Department of Defense on certain issues, such as security assistance, but then it actually resonates with other foreign policy tools that the United States and other states could use to affect the reform making in Ukraine. No one is talking about micromanaging, but between micromanaging and complete deference to the military on the ground, there's a whole range of opportunities that could have been explored, but so far I don't see it in Ukraine and in many other cases. I just don't see sufficient political presence of U.S. civilians that could influence the outcomes on the ground.
Thank you for that, Paulina. I think that a consistent issue is getting high-level attention from Washington. Ambassadors have a lot of authority as chief of mission, but they're responding to those signals about what Washington cares about. And military reform and security sector governance, I think, has, for not just in Ukraine, but a lot of cases, is not viewed as the main effort, as the most important. So I think we consistently underestimate how important this ends up being, even though we're literally seeing it right now, how you need to fix these things in order to generate efficient combat power. There is no military power without addressing the sources of it, which are in these civil-military relations, which are in how a military's institutions function. So to me, it's kind of the main effort, and it always has been when we think about working with allies and partners. But somehow that's still kind of lost in translation when you think about the dynamics of everyday U.S. policy making towards a country like Ukraine.
Yeah, but you also have to look at how much the State Department has been gutted over the last 10 years.
And even longer than that, I agree with you. It's even more than 10 years. It's a consistent process. Yeah. And again, it's something that's going on the U.S. side, not the Ukrainian side, that we also have to be very cognizant about.
Absolutely. And this has been one of the problems, is that you do have a decline in terms of, you know, the quality and capacity of people within state. During Iraq and Afghanistan, they went to one-year rotations. What the hell can you know about a country in 1 year? You go for a year of language training and then you're deployed for, you know, 2 years to a place. What can you possibly know about it or understand it?
Don, I really like that you talk about quality and length of deployment and not the quantity, because often the quantity is the main excuse. It's like the DoD has more people, but it's not about the quantity of people. It's about the quality and expertise that comes with the length of deployment. You're correct.
Absolutely. And so, you know, this is what shocked me the most about the surge in Afghanistan when I met an American and we were talking about agriculture. And I said, well, what about all those mines left over from the previous war? And he said, what previous war? So he had only been to two countries, the U.S. and Afghanistan. So, you know, this has been one of the problems that we have, is that, yes, if you have 100 well-informed people who understand the region, speak the languages, know the history, they're far more effective than 2,000 or 3,000 bodies thrown at it. I agree. And this has been one of the problems, is the great pivot to the Middle East that happened, you know, in 2001. And so since then, what we've seen is that the regional capacity, I mean, I can count on my fingers the number of old Soviet hands who were in Kyiv. You didn't have people. British Embassy had two people who had any regional experience. The American Embassy, yeah, kind of, you know, one guy, but nowhere in terms of the depths that you had before. So having been coming and going from Ukraine for the last 30 plus years, you saw that, you know, the first people who came in were Moscow centric, but at least they understood the region. And then after that, after the great pivot towards the Middle East that happened in the 2000s, then you lost all of that regional capacity. So this has been one of the problems, is that Ukraine studies was largely limited to the diaspora, right? So it was kind of a miserable sort of thing. I used to always go to the regional meetings and things like that, and you would see who did Ukraine. And there was sort of this always this looking down from the Moscow people of, you know, oh, guys out in the provinces. So if you were Central Asia, Caucasus, or Ukraine, you know, Moldova, you weren't quite as important. And so everything has always been very Moscow-centric. And that's been one of the real problems. There's very few people, even now, who have the capacity to understand what has gone on the last 30 years in Ukraine.
So to sum some things up here, the international community is not doing as much as it could be doing. That's limited partly by the fact that there isn't the high-level attention on the reform efforts as well as the people on the ground that we might want to see. And so there's some skepticism about whether this even can be done. But could you talk a little bit more about why it should be done? Why is this important? What's at stake about how these governance issues unfold in Ukraine? And what can and should the international community be doing?
So I will make a small point on this, why it should be done and how it should be done. I agree with Don that reforms are not happening because of the lack of political will. And there is a distribution of power on the ground between different actors and institutions that produce this outcome, that actually impede the development of the political will. And if we imagine the distribution of power on the ground as a certain kind of balance that prevents the reforms, what Western partners could do is to, again, throw their power into the mix to change this balance and to make reforms or pro-reform groups, including those that Don already mentioned that worked in the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, and try to promote reforms, throwing more political weight behind the reformers can change the balance of power on the ground and make reforms possible, beneficial, and in the best case scenario, inevitable. Again, I cannot underscore the importance of the defense procurement reform, because it's not only about the ability of Ukraine to procure the weapons that Ukraine produces. It's about the ability of Ukraine to defend itself in the future, but also to maintain some level of trust between the government, the military, and the society. Because inability to procure in a timely manner the weapon that Ukraine produces itself sends a very anxiety-provoking signal to the, again, the society and also to the military. And in light of the upcoming mobilization, undermines the societal trust in the government and the military. So yes, the Western partners should devote not more people, not even more money, but more political power to affect the outcomes on the ground and explore the range between micromanagement and complete withdrawal from the political reality, letting the partner do everything. Because what's at stake is the present as well as the future of Ukraine.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Polina just said. You know, for me, on the corruption issue, because that's my thing, is that it's reached a point where somebody needs to do an intervention. The alcoholic has already destroyed the house and everything else. So there's a point in which grown-ups in the room have to sit down and have a real intervention, not just to protect their own weapon systems and everything else or their assistance, but to stop the internal destruction that could lead to very bad things happening in Ukraine and across the board. And again, the disconnect comes from, I don't think there's enough people in the international community talking directly to average Ukrainians and the guys at the front and everything else. So I spent the summer of 22 going all along the front lines in the newly liberated territories, talking to people, getting their views on stabilization, what needs to be done in stabilization, sometimes under direct fire. And, You know, I mean, this is what has to be done. How many other people? In fact, I was told by the guys at the Canadian embassy, oh, we don't go to those places. That's way too dangerous. Well, how do you get direct information? So it has to be done. It has to be an understanding that right now is a critical point. And yes, it may not be very pretty to go and to say, guys, you have to push through these reforms. But what other choice is there really on this? And so this is my big fear that keeps me up at night, is that things need to change. And it is exactly as Paulina said, it's only going to be by the Western powers coming in and saying, okay, we will continue to support you. We will continue to do what you ask of us. But you also have to be serious about pushing through these reforms. And this just hasn't happened.
So it sounds like any long-term outcome of the war that is on terms favorable to Ukraine and to the stability of the European continent, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, kind of depends on the success of these efforts. How do you see these things tying into what we might think of as long-term outcomes?
Yes, the future of European security depends on what goes on in Ukraine. Everybody knows that. The Eastern Europeans definitely know this. Western Europeans, not so sure.
I probably will change the direction of thought here a bit. And yes, the survival of Ukraine depends on the ability of the Ukrainian government to implement these reforms successfully. At the same time, there is an elephant in the room that we did not address, and it's the US material assistance, as in training and equipment. That at this point, the Ukrainian government does not see a clear commitment. We are all aware of the situation now with the Ukrainian aid. And for Ukrainian society, there is also a question. Will I have enough artillery shells to be of any use in the front lines? And inability of the United States to sustain a commitment to supporting Ukraine as a foreign policy priority and not a foreign policy charity case, and I understand that I'm using very strong words here, is an important change that has to happen on the US side. Keeping Ukraine alive should not be a charity case in US foreign policy. The United States, by providing weapons and assistance to Ukraine, pursues its foreign policy goals. And these foreign policy goals and preferences have to be clearly formulated, not in terms of saving Ukrainian lives, but in terms of preserving the favorable balance of power in Europe, favorable for or preferable for the United States. And for that, the United States and Western European partners have to answer the question, how strong would they like Russia to be in Europe? Because I see recently the conversation is changing into how much should we support Ukraine for the sake of Ukrainians to survive? And as a Ukrainian, I'm very grateful to that. But as a political scientist, my question is, what are your foreign policy interests? What are your national interests? And what is the image of Russia in those? If the United States does not mind to see stronger Russia in Europe, if Western European countries do not mind seeing stronger Russia in Europe and probably several more invasions on the Russian borders, then no problem. This kind of haphazard support provision can continue or stop at all, it doesn't matter. But if the US foreign policy preferences involve keeping Russia out of Europe, that's exactly how the United States should consider Ukraine when deciding on the provision of training, equipment, and weapon systems. So I think there is an important mindset change that have to happen here on this side of the Atlantic Ocean as to about why the United States even helping Ukraine. It cannot be about, again, being kind to Ukrainians or providing the weapons to support the right cause. It has to be about mitigating the foreign policy risks, including those that you mentioned, and pursuing foreign policy preferences that, again, do not involve charity or goodwill, but are rather pragmatic and have very concrete answers about how strong would you like Russia to be? And what is your role in Europe? And that's the question for the United States, of course. What is the preferred role of the United States in Europe? And there are many answers to this question. There are different schools of thought. And I do not advocate for any of those. But I'm advocating for a broader point, that that's exactly how the calculation has to be made, not counting the number of Ukrainian casualties, for example, or the percentage of lost territory. But what are the implications of losing this or that percentage of the territory for US foreign policy goals and preferences in Europe?
Yeah, but this has been one of the big issues, is that since the start of the war, it's been a PR campaign. Ukraine is our superpower. You have to help us because we're the good guys. Ignoring the cold, hard realities of why people should support Ukraine. A friend of mine's going to give a briefing to Johnson in the next couple of days. And he asked me for some bullet points. Bullet points I said was 80% of all U.S. military assistance stays in the U.S. It's not a charity case. It's creating a lot of jobs in Pennsylvania at the ammo factories and everything else. That's some cold, hard realities. When I was in the spring last year in Kiev, one of the things that we were looking at trying to do is to get conservative Ukrainians to go to the U.S. and talk to conservative Republicans in key electoral districts, especially those that are producing weapons. No support for that. Nobody wanted to do that, including the Ukrainian government. They didn't understand why that was needed, right? And I'm sorry, but this PR campaign of Petron the bomb-sniffing dog has been great, great public image and great everything. But these are PR things. They're not strategic communications. The Ukraine, at best, is doing tactical communications, right? They're good at getting out bits of battles and things like that instead of doing the big strategic picture, which is exactly what we're discussing. It's in everybody's interest to support Ukraine. Not because they're the good guys, not because they have cute dogs, not because whatever, but it's in everybody's hardcore interest. And that's an argument that you can win over the naysayers on Ukrainian aid.
Thank you both so much for this. I want to close with one question, and that's, we have a scholar and a practitioner here in the room. What is your advice to scholars and practitioners that are working on these issues that we discussed in the podcast?
Get your hands dirty. Go there. Go to Ukraine. See what it's like firsthand, right? There's lots of safe ways to do it. Let me just tell you a little story. The guys who are looking at the foreign training of Ukrainian troops from the Minerva Project, which you know very well, Alex, they're not allowed to go to Ukraine. Well, at least they're not allowed to spend U.S. government money in Ukraine. So they pay to their own pocket. That's dedication. And that's what needs to be done. Go firsthand, see actually what's going on. There's lots of safe ways to do it.
Yeah, my advice is similar. But on the intellectual level, read Ukrainian scholars. Get familiar with the country before you use your expertise to give any advice on that. I would recommend spending the first year just asking questions of different people and sources, and only then starting to very modestly try to apply any kind of area of expertise that a scholar already has to the case of Ukraine. Ukraine is typical in many ways and is peculiar in many ways. And to distinguish between what is typical and what is peculiar, you have to first start asking questions and get to know the country, either by going there or at least by reading the local sources. And we have great Ukrainian scholars here and there, just to understand the case. It's important to understand the case.
Absolutely.
Thank you both. And we have our very own great Ukrainian scholar right here with us today, Polina. So thank you for that.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
And I've just found a way, an easy way for me to get Ukrainian citizenship. So I'll be the same.
Meet up in Kyiv after we sort out our travel.
Thank you for listening to the Social Science of War podcast. This podcast was brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider subscribing, leave a rating and comment, and most importantly, please share the Social Science of War with others. One final note, what you heard in this episode does not represent the views of West Point or any other agency of the U.S. government.